The Tom Woods Show, episode 444.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, reminding you that you can get one of my books as an audiobook for free at tomwoodsaudio.com. You could get my New York Times bestsellers Meltdown on the Financial Crisis, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, and The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, or Nullification, or Rollback, or my latest book with me reading it, Real Dissent. Check it out at tomwoodsaudio.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. The 14th Amendment is our subject for today. This is a subject of controversy all over the place. It's controversial within libertarianism. It's controversial within conservatism. It's controversial across the board. So we want to talk about it. Now, of course, let me just put it this way. In typical America today, it's not controversial at all. But on the other hand, mainstream America thinks that a matchup between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton would be really exciting. So I'm not really concerned about what they think is interesting. I happen to think the 14th Amendment is interesting, important, and is debatable. So we're going to talk about it today with Kevin Gutzman, our old friend. Kevin Gutzman, as you may know, is co-author with me of Who Killed the Constitution, a book from 2008. But in his own right, he is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, a New York Times bestseller, Virginia's American Revolution, and James Madison and the Making of America. Kevin is a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, and he holds a PhD in American history from the University of Virginia. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here, Tom.
The 14th Amendment is in the news. It's always in the news. Federal government is always doing something with it. You would think it would have plenty already in the Constitution the way it wants to interpret it, that it wouldn't even need the 14th Amendment, but indeed it uses it. And it came up recently in the decision related to same-sex marriage, but it really is all over the place. So I thought it was important to clarify what it means. Let's just look at the history. Well, first let's look at the text of it. When you look at the 14th Amendment, we're really only concerned with Section 1, because the rest of it is more or less irrelevant to us today, about the Confederate debt and, you know, the voting for Confederates or whatever. We're really mainly talking about Section 1. So what, leaving aside what Section 1 is supposed to mean, what do we encounter, what are the principles that we encounter in the text of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment?
Well, of course, the very first part is the statement revoking the court's decision in Dred Scott versus Sanford that somebody who's black cannot be a citizen of the United States, regardless whether he's a citizen of his state. And then you have the Equal Protection Clause, which says that no state may deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws. Actually, before that, there's a due process clause which bans states from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process. And this has come to be the most significant part of the Constitution. It's often as if nothing else existed.
The second question is, according to, well, the best we can figure, what was the 14th Amendment intended to do? Today we have people who are extremely and probably willfully naive about the 14th Amendment, who would not be naive about other parts of the Constitution, who would say, well, it originally meant this, but now they've expanded it to mean that. Whereas today there are a lot of libertarians who want the 14th Amendment to mean certain things, and whereas I think it's the same story with the 14th Amendment. It originally meant one thing, now it means another. What did it originally mean?
Well, what happened was that in the wake of the Civil War, several Southern states at the first opportunity in 1866 elected their traditional political leaders to be members of Congress. So you had Confederate senators, Confederate generals, the Confederate vice president show up in Washington, D.C., ready to take the oath of office. And the Congress, the Republican Congress, decided not to seat them. Besides that, the Southern states decided almost immediately that, well, if there wasn't going to be slavery, there still had to be labor, or everybody in the South was going to starve. And so they passed what were called black codes, essentially making the next thing to indentured servants or serfs of the former slaves. And so Congress in 1866 passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, whose purpose was to extend the most basic rights to black Southerners. In fact, rights more basic than we even think of when we think of rights, such as the right to make a contract and actually have the other party pay you, for example, the right to go to court. And of course, the people who ran the Congress at that point were faced with a problem, because now that they had freed the slaves, once Southern states had the benefit of the next census, there would actually be more people from the Southern states in Congress than there had been before. Rather than counting each as three-fifths of a person as before, all those formerly enslaved people would now count each of them as a person. So South Carolina, Alabama, Arkansas, and so on would have more congressmen than they had before. There was every reason to think that they would never be Republicans, that they would always oppose Republicans, because the war had come to be a Republican war. And so what to do? Well, one part of the answer was the 14th Amendment, whose purpose was to constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Actually, President Johnson, who by a freak coincidence was a Southern Democrat who succeeded Lincoln as president when Lincoln was assassinated, President Johnson had vetoed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and Congress overrode his veto. So they had every reason to think that when Congress once again was controlled by the Democrats, and when there was a Democrat in the White House — there usually, of course, had been a Democrat in the White House — that the Civil Rights Act of 1866 would be repealed. Well, how to avoid that? Well, make an amendment instantiating that in the fundamental law so that Congress could not repeal it once Southerners once again were represented in Congress. And that was what the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was sold as doing by its proponents at the time. In fact, one leading Republican senator, a moderate, who was trying to sell this to his constituents in Ohio, John Sherman, a frequent contender for the presidential nomination of the Republican Party, and of course also the brother of Union General William Tecumseh Sherman. John Sherman told his constituents in Ohio not to worry about the 14th Amendment because, he said, it would have no effect in Ohio. Well, why would it have no effect in Ohio? Because in Ohio, regardless what color you were, you could already make a contract and enforce it. You could already, you know, go to court and so on. You didn't have to worry about these things. So this was entirely about giving former slaves in the South the basic rights that, as I said before, we so take for granted that nobody would even think of them. If you said, name me 50 of your rights, nobody would say the right to make a contract for labor and actually be paid for labor. So that's what it was for.
Yet the language – so when we get the 14th Amendment, which is meant to make sure that acts like this couldn't be challenged constitutionally, the language that's used, though, is extremely – it sounds, at least to the untrained ear, the ear that it didn't go to law school, sounds extremely sweeping. It doesn't just confine itself to these specific and as you say, very, very limited rights, but talks about the equal protection of the laws and so on and so forth. And so this has been interpreted to mean, for example, in the not in the decision itself, but among, let's say, popular renditions of the same-sex marriage decision that one might encounter on Facebook. I can't believe I'm even talking about this. But on Facebook, you would encounter libertarians who would say, oh, it's a simple case. It's equal protection of the laws. It's right there in the 14th Amendment. If you have straight marriage being protected in different states, then same-sex marriage has to be protected. It's just simple application of the 14th Amendment. Why are they wrong when that very language does appear to be right there in the amendment?
Well, this question is a product of a kind of legal gamesmanship I referred to earlier. I mean, historically in America, a marriage was a relationship that was entered into knowing that it was going to be heterosexual, it was going to be monogamous, they were going to be adults, it was going to be non-incestuous, and they were going to be living human beings, right? Now, saying that people who want to have a different kind of relationship than the one I've just described are not being given the equal benefit of access to marriage is just inaccurate. Everybody prior to this Obergefell decision had equal access to monogamous, heterosexual, non-incestuous, adult, human living being relationship called marriage. It's just that some people, particular classes of people, don't want that kind of relationship. They want a different kind of relationship and they want to call it marriage. So what's happened is that lawyers have played the game of saying, well, these people who want a different kind of relationship want the courts to force state legislatures to grant them this different kind of relationship. And the reason, of course, is that in most of the states, the people weren't going to vote for that. And so what you could do, and judges, lawyers have been trained for decades now to do this, you can try to force this into the equal protection category and say, well, really, these unlike things are alike, you know? But they're not. If you want to marry your sister, or you want to marry two people, or your dog, or your mother, or your friend Bob, that is not a marriage. That's a different kind of relationship. Now, it's a different question whether society should say, well, we're going to recognize that too, but we're going to extend various kinds of protections or, you know, benefits to people who want to enter into some other kind of relationship than marriage. But what the availability of this equal protection peg in the 14th Amendment has encouraged lawyers to do over time is to torture definitions so that they can supposedly bring them under this equality rubric and thereby give federal judges who might agree with them about the policy they're seeking to have enforced an opportunity to enforce the policy on an unwilling state or sometimes on an unwilling country. That to me is what happened in Obergefell. People who for whatever reason, and we don't really know whether homosexuality, you know, we don't know to what extent it's hereditary, to what extent it's environmental, to what extent it's a choice, but for some reason, some people don't want marriage, but they do want to have intimate, lasting relationships like marriage. And so they just decided, all right, well, I can't get the electorate here in Iowa or Alabama or wherever to recognize this way. So I'll just go tell a federal judge that he should say this is required by a free-floating equality concept that federal judges have invented in the name of the 14th Amendment over the last several generations.
All right, let me play devil's advocate here. Can't we say that the 14th Amendment has done some good in its expansive version, in the judicial activist version of it, which would apply it in situations well beyond the ones you described at the beginning of this episode, when we're talking about people, you know, not being kept from suing in the courts and entering into labor contracts and so on. But it's been applied to many, many types of situations well beyond those limited ones. Isn't this an instrument that the federal government can use to strike down obnoxious anti-liberty measures at the state level? And so, you know, who really cares whether it was the original intent of the 14th Amendment or not? If it does some good, then it does some good.
Well, the problem here is that once you've unmoored what the court is saying about the Constitution from the Constitution itself, you don't really have an idea how broadly the court will use the power you're granting it. In other words, if the limits of its power aren't defined by the Constitution, what are the limits of its power? So under this rubric of free-floating equality mandate in the 14th Amendment, federal courts in the last few decades have ordered tens of millions of little kids to ride buses for thousands of hours a year. They have, one court in Missouri imposed a statewide tax increase that was in effect for over a decade in the name of this. There have been various clearly anti-liberty policies that were imposed on the people by this kind of judicial sleight of hand too. So I think also in the long run, people should be concerned with the idea that because it seems to be of immediate benefit to them and people who agree with them. They are erecting a theoretical edifice that allows judges effectively just to do whatever they want. I mean, what this Obergefell case represents is a tradition now going back decades of allowing federal judges just to veto any state law they don't like. And let's not put any finer point on it than that. That's all that happened here. In fact, people who favored the outcome in this case knew that that was what was going to happen here. There was a couple of days before the case was handed down, before the decision was handed down, a long story in the New York Times about Justice Kennedy and his lifelong associations with homosexual friends and so on. This could have been a perfectly good description of a legislator who was successfully guiding his preferred policy through the Congress or through the state legislature of his state. But Anthony Kennedy's personal musings on policy should not be what we're subject to, because we don't have any control over Anthony Kennedy at all. And again, he could clap your kid in a bus for hundreds of hours a year, or he could make you pay higher taxes for a decade, or he could do anything he wants to you. And there's nothing you can do about it. So that's why I find the idea that, well, it's okay that they behave this way because usually they're advancing some generalized notion of liberty. I don't even think that is a valid argument. And actually, this whole argument reminds me of my favorite scene in one of the best Hollywood productions ever, A Man for All Seasons, where ultimately Sir Thomas More is told, I think, by his son-in-law that, well, he'd be happy to see the law violated in order to have a particular rather unsavory fellow jailed. And Moore says to him, well, you know, you better be careful. You better give the devil the benefit of the law, because if you go around chopping down all the laws in the kingdom, eventually the devil can turn on you. And what will there be for you to hide behind? So that's where we are. So let's not play this game of saying, well, it's the Constitution. You know, the people agreed to this. We ratified it, or it was given us by those magical geniuses who wrote it or something. No, that's not what we have here. What we have here is brute power. That's all there is to it. There are five people on the Supreme Court who didn't like the fact that most of the states weren't going in any particular hurry to legalize gay marriage, and they wanted it legalized now. So they just decreed that that the Constitution required it. That's all there is to it.
Kevin, before we go on, let's pause for a minute and thank our sponsor. Hey, everybody. If you're listening to this podcast, I know you love audio content, and I'm happy to tell you that many of my books are available as audiobooks. And I'm happier still to tell you that you can get one of them for free through the offer at TomWoodsAudio.com. That would include my New York Times bestseller, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, Meltdown, my book on the financial crisis, another New York Times bestseller featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, my latest book, Real Descent, and a number of others are available to choose from when you choose your free audiobook through TomWoodsAudio.com. It comes with a 30-day free trial to Audible. And if you never want to deal with Audible again, you just cancel and you keep your free audiobook. So you have nothing to lose and everything to gain by heading over to TomWoodsAudio.com. Kevin, tell us who Raoul Berger was and what he has to do with this.
Raoul Berger was a classical violinist, for one thing.
I didn't know that.
He was actually an outstanding violinist who played with some of the leading symphonies in the United States. He also was a New Deal lawyer, one of those young attorneys who went to Washington, D.C. to work in Franklin Roosevelt's administration. Eventually, he became a legal historian at the Harvard Law School, and in that capacity, he wrote several outstanding books. My favorite book on federal impeachment, for example, is called Impeachment, the Constitutional Problems. But the most important thing he wrote and he also wrote a really good book about the myth of executive privilege. Anybody who believes in that idea should read that book. But the best book he wrote, and I think the best book in the whole field of American legal history, is called A Government by Judiciary, The Transformation of the 14th Amendment. What Berger does in that book, Government by Judiciary, is to show with copious primary material that the 14th Amendment was sold to the people at the time as having very narrow application. It was going to affect southern states as they were trying to erect some new system of racial subordination. And that's where I got the quote I gave you earlier from John Sherman saying this will have no effect in Ohio. Man, has there been a prediction that's proven more unfounded than that? But
well, maybe the extent of the income tax that we would be subject to was another one that we have disproved over the years.
Well, yes, that's true. And actually, my father, when I was a child, was friends with the meteorologist who told Adolf Hitler that on June 6, 1944, the skies over Normandy would be too overcast for a landing. So,
oh, okay. All right.
That was a bad prediction, too, I guess. There's some question how it was that he survived that mistake. But in any event, Sherman was clearly entirely wrong. And yet, if you read the history of the 14th Amendment's drafting and ratification, I think it's clear that the current use of, or at least the current invocation of the 14th Amendment in order to rationalize wide-ranging legislative authority for federal judges is absolutely unlike what the people who were responsible for the 14th Amendment thought they were doing.
I read that book, Government by Judiciary, a long time ago. Liberty Fund published a very nice edition of it. It's a big book. If you want to get the gist of his thesis, though, you can. He has a much shorter book and much less well-known book, just called The 14th Amendment and the Bill of Rights, which will give you, in which he's replying to critics, but it'll give you the gist of his argument. Kevin, before I let you go, a somewhat unrelated question regarding the 14th Amendment. Back when we were talking about the possibility that the U.S. might default on some of its debt payments, which we all knew that was a scare tactic, although I don't think there's anything particularly scary about it, but we all knew it wasn't actually going to happen. But there is in the 14th Amendment in Section 4 this provision that says the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for the payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. And people said, well, you see, the Constitution requires that the federal government make these debt payments. Look, it shall not be questioned. Now, to me, it seems pretty obvious based on the next sentence of Section 4 that the context of that is that the federal debt will be considered legitimate, but the Confederate debt will not. Is that your take?
Yes, it is.
Well, good. Well, that solves that problem. So, in other words, context is everything.
Yes, and that's what they don't tell you when they're introducing you to the Supreme Court's handiwork in connection with the 14th Amendment in law school. It's just kind of free-floating. You know, in the Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, I devote some attention to the issue of the way that American lawyers are educated, because so long as they are educated about the Constitution solely by being given opinions of dead judges to read, there's no chance that they will cease enforcing on us this, I'd say, completely un-American system we have now, where, as in Iran or Egypt, the people are allowed to have their little elections, but in the end, the people who really count will decide what the policies are. And so it's a terrible thing, I think, that in the end we've ended up with this system we have where we're all subject to Anthony Kennedy's philosophical stylings. You know, some fellow from 60s California background is accidentally plopped onto the Supreme Court, and the next thing you know, he's giving us the Casey opinion, and he's giving us an opinion enforcing this policy on gay marriage in the whole country and so on. And by the way, people listening to this shouldn't have the impression that I'm saying I don't approve of the Supreme Court when they disagree with my policy preferences. My state of Connecticut had decided to have gay marriage, and that was perfectly constitutional. What's not constitutional is enforcing it on the whole country under the guise of a policy that's required by the 14th Amendment.
Well, I'm going to urge people to read The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. It is probably one of my top 10 books I would recommend to people, even for people who say they're not interested in the Constitution. You will be after you read this. There is nothing like it. That is not an exaggeration. It is a stunning book. When I read The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, which was a New York Times bestseller, I'm happy to say, I thought to myself, my own politically incorrect guide is just the work of a lazy bum compared to this thing. Like, it was so, so good. So you should check that out. That is one of the books you can get for as a free audiobook through the TomWoodsAudio.com offer. So definitely check that out. Kevin, again, as always, I'm glad to talk to you. I'm glad that you are fearless. You couldn't care less what the people on Facebook have to say. I love reading what you have to say on Facebook. I don't know where you find the time, frankly. But anyway, I'm glad to be your friend both on Facebook and in the real world. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Tom.
All right, everybody, two things. Remember the show notes page, tomwoods.com/444, and libertyclassroom.com. Kevin teaches there with me. This is the site we started when we realized that instead of just being frustrated at the propaganda that so many people unfortunately get when they try to study history and economics, instead of just being frustrated at that, we could create our own courses in history and economics and philosophy and get them out there to the public over the heads of the academic establishment. Fun and exciting. Great for you because you get 13 courses now over there, plus Q&A forums, get all your questions answered anytime you want. Recommended reading so you don't have to sift through what's reliable and what isn't. Believe me, we've done the sifting. So check it out over at libertyclassroom.com and use coupon code SHOW in all caps to get yourself a discount. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about egalitarianism and all the problems with the arguments for equality. Oh my goodness, will this be controversial, but fun. So make sure and tune in then. We'll see you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.